stand to right. We're getting, this is getting, setting it up for after supper. This Tuesday, the 27th of March, 73, we've got to go with Mr. Weavers and break the news. We may do that before we have our little session this Tuesday, the 27th of March, 73. When you get through, is to take the thing out, and the rest out won't hurt it. That little, you know, my.
Yeah. Looked like he was feeling pretty good tonight.
Yeah, he was. Okay.
Yeah.
He certainly had enough strength in those hands. My gosh, he was talking about wrestling somebody and getting them right on the kidney, right on the other side of his spine. So he got both of us with his knuckle just right there. Oh, really hurt.
Something about somebody that wants to wrestle you and you want to stay in the chair. And then they start working up your arm and you're going,
Rick said, "Hey, Mr. Weaver, you're hurting my arm." He says, "Cause Mr. Weaver's coming up to the mic."
He grabbed me on the shoulder and I went, "Wow!"
And then he comes around. He comes around and Rick the tape cord's over here, and he comes around like this, and he's got his hand here, you know, punching Rick in the back and sort of moving his hand. Rick's getting paler and paler. He sat down in the wooden chair that rolls, you know. And he's sitting over here, and Mr. Weaver's here. And so Rick sits down, and he's like this. He's got his shoulders over here, his shoulders over here.
I'm rolling over.
And then he starts rolling like this. I just get closer and closer.
This thing was making a little squeaking sound.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He goes,
yeah, they've done that.
Well, what's that sound?
Oh, is that what it was?
What's the sound? I go, oh, no, it's a cricket. It's a cricket.
I thought it was a bug out. I know what it said. Anything if I known it was the machine. Get it?
Mr. Weaver says it must be a spider. They make noises.
I couldn't imagine what it was. I knew it sounded like a machine.
You boil it and take out a little of it, but not all of it.
No.
That's one reason I quit using those, because they don't make the machine solid.
You stand in a tape and go, squeak, squeak.
And then at the end, it has a little alarm.
Oh, it does. The alarm goes off.
I didn't know what it was.
I was doing it, sitting there, taking it all in, yeah.
What does he say just before we leave? Well, I hope you all are warm enough tonight.
Yeah. Talking about this coat we're off.
Magazine? You haven't been reading your magazine.
Huh?
You haven't been reading here. Pull up the chair. What's the cut in you?
I don't know. What's
my car? If they put something in you and you didn't put it in mine.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me you haven't been reading. You just have a chair. I got something to show you.
Just sit down there, Mr. Weaver. Just sit down.
I sat the chair up, but he went and sat the easy chair.
Don't watch me now.
That's when he was sitting down.
Why don't I want to watch you?
Hmm? I was going to get something. You look kind of way.
All right.
He was reaching out for a magazine.
Oh, he was reaching for a magazine.
You got your issue?
Yeah, I got mine too.
Now, wait a minute. No, Mr. Weaver, look at what the date is on that.
Huh?
That ain't February.
Yeah, it is.
No way.
Well, that's January.
That's January.
I'm talking about February.
You want February?
Oh! You were waiting for the joke on me. Let me get out. Here's one. That's right, man. How about you, dude? Come up here and get mine?
No, I didn't come up here and get yours. That's it.
I've been hunting, put it in
the
envelope. Mm-hmm.
You've been reading
what'd
it?
What'd you do, slip it in here?
I didn't do a thing, Mr. Weaver. I just wanted to know if you've been reading your magazine. Say along about page 61.
61?
Uh-huh.
Coming through his magazine.
I can't find it.
There's nothing in there, Mr. Weaver.
No?
Have you got page 61 yet?
Who'd use that? Well, you're just different. Come out later than mine, you see. I've had mine some other time. You were just a little bit late in that.
Okay, page 64, you got to go on another page, too.
What do you say is page 61?
61. You got one more page to go.
61?
Mm-hmm.
I bet your coon dog.
Yeah, he's reading.
You run the big and old the fence and let him through the crack.
Where are you reading, Mr. Weaver?
That's what's on this page that you said. That I bought me a coon dog to run the big and old the fence and let him through the crack.
You're not reading the right place, Mr. Weaver.
I couldn't find it.
How about that?
Now, don't that say that. Read that right up there now. Don't say
it.
I bought
me a coon dog.
Yeah,
you said, I bought me a coon dog and ran the little one, big one through the fence and the little one through the crack. That's
no,
what
big and old fence.
Oh, look at that. That's something. Yes, sir.
You done a good job, but you always talked about something good.
Well, you wouldn't tell me anything good, Mr. Weaver.
I told you.
This is long before you told me something good.
No.
Yes. That's been...
You didn't put the
date 3 months ago.
You didn't put my picture in there. And these other fellas got pictures in there.
We'll get your picture in.
I'd already found it.
You didn't tell me.
Well, I didn't do your night, and I was trying to take you that story and tell it like it was, and I fell through it, I think.
Isn't that cute? He was pulling your leg out of
you. He just let us walk right into it and was going to pull a January issue on us.
And I wouldn't let him do it. I said, no, that's not the February issue, that's the January issue. And then he opens it up to the page and reads it.
Well, I thought you'd get something when he just saw his name up there at the top of the page and Hunter's Horn.
if you look at this. You just sat back as quiet as you please and wait for us to bring it up. Just carried us along.
And he chided me because I wouldn't let him use the other magazine.
Wanted his picture. It was a kind of a rambling talk. He never really got on dogs. He told about one fight he was in. That was the only best thing I think he hang on to. Wrestling the guy. He picked up hitchhiking. The guy wouldn't get out of the truck. So he just pulled him out and squeezed him.
What was that? Tonight?
And then he added on some more to that story about work.
Yeah.
He was trying to buy the dog. And then a little bit more about Julie. And it turns out Emler Keep was on that hunt and Emler was drunk.
Oh, he was high.
I don't know what all is in it. It's probably a lot more than I realized.
Yeah.
But I kept trying to stay around dogs, and I'd say something, he would just ignore me and go right on. He was getting pretty sharp.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can't fool him. Don't get cold now.
And pretended to look for the February issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, we gave him a chance, didn't we? Well, it's taken him a long time to get it. You know, it's an amazing thing. It's hard to understand. Anyone who talks as much as he does is willingly, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And to as many people, and he's the only one who doesn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it.
Well, it's just the beginning.
Too late.
Well, let me get my thoughts back from Mr. Weaver. Well, we went down to Sarasota this weekend because Selby came. And Selby Marsh and I used to work at Tufts all together. And she's been planning to come all spring, but she couldn't get any vacation from her job. She's in Chicago now, working with my old boss, who left Tufts and went to Chicago to the AHA, and got a job for Selby out there. So we were going to have this big reunion to go down. Well, I got home on Thursday, and my sister said, "Well, guess what tomorrow is? It's Selby's birthday." I said, "Oh, gosh, I didn't remember that." She said, "Well, what we're going to do is we're going to go to temple with Selby. Selby's Jewish. Selby wants to go to temple on her birthday. And Marsh and Robert have to go to the senior play at the high school, so they're going to do that, and we're going to go to temple with the baby." So I said, "Well, you know, okay." So we drove down. We stopped in St. Petersburg and saw some friends there of my sister's, and then we went on down to Sarasota, and we got there for supper. And I had really forgotten how funny Selby is. She's so funny. She just kept us laughing till our sides hurt the whole time. She's talking about her trip to Europe last year and being in Rome by herself, but well, that comes a little bit later. But
well, you know, I'm curious. I just want to know what's funny. I just want to hear something funny again. Yeah.
I got it.
So long.
Well, so we're going to go to temple that night. I'd laugh, and I said, "Selby, you're just getting religion on us." This is, "No, you go to temple twice a year. You go on Rosh Hashanah and your birthday."
She says, yeah, but I want to go to temple tonight. So we got all ready. We're telling this little baby who's two that she's going to temple, and she's getting all excited and got going. So we drove up, and we were going to meet some friends of Marsh and Roberts there, who are an ex-nun and an ex-priest, who left the convent and got married, and they had never been in a synagogue either. I'd never been to a Friday night service in a synagogue before. So Selby just felt like she was really the tour leader with all these Gentiles going to synagogue. So we were going to meet them there, Frank and Sue. So we drove up, and there were all these cars there. The parking lot was packed, and Selby looked at this, and she said, my gosh, I hope we're not walking into a wedding or something. And I said, well, Selby, we'll just leave. We can't go to somebody's wedding. And she said, oh, of course you can. If it's Friday night, anybody can go. Anybody can walk in off the street and go. And I said, well, all right. So we parked the car. They had policemen there to park the cars and everything. It was really crowded. So we walked in, and the sanctuary was already full. It was packed. There were no seats. And they were starting to put folding chairs in this little sort of reception room behind the sanctuary. So Selby looks around, and she says, I'm going to find out what's going on here. She said, just wait a minute. So Phoebe and I sort of waited, you know, and held the baby. And she went and talked to one of the ushers. And she came back, and she said, well, not only is there a bar mitzvah tonight, but the B'nai B'rith sponsored an essay contest in Israel. And the three winners of the essay contest are here from Israel tonight. Everybody in the Jewish community in Sarasota is here. So we said, well, you know, we're really gonna get a show tonight, aren't we? She said, yeah, I think so. She said, and a bar mitzvah too. She said. So we sat down, and Frank and Susan arrived, and Gerald, another friend of theirs. And so they got their yarmulkes on, and we all sat down, you know, and they tried to start the service. The poor rabbi is standing up speaking into the loudspeaker. We're going to start the service now. We're going to start the service now. And everybody's talking away, you know. I think we're going to start the service, he says. I want to get this started on time. I thought of the first time I went home with my roommate Marcia Gold for Passover. I had never been to a Seder before, and I thought that Passover is sort of an important Jewish holiday. And then I thought, well, this is going to be sort of solemn. And as it turned out, her father and her brother sat at one end of the table and read the service in Hebrew back and forth, back and forth. And everybody else carried on normal conversation through the whole service. And I thought, well, it's the same thing. They're just pretty casual about talking in services. So they finally started the service. And we just watched because there weren't any more prayer books. They were all inside, and so Selby sang along, but the rest of us just watched. And it was really sort of touching, the little boy that sang for his bar mitzvah. That's beautiful to see. His bar mitzvah was actually the next morning, but he has to come and sing in at shul on Friday night. And they open up the Holy of Holies, so that has the Torah in it, and he's the next morning we'll read from the Torah, but that night he led the congregation singing. And it was really nice to hear. He had this high little child's voice. He was only about 12, singing in front of the whole congregation. It was really something. But we just started picking up these little glimpses, you see. We weren't in the sanctuary, so we couldn't really follow the service. We were sitting out. And then for another thing, we didn't have a prayer book, and we didn't understand Hebrew anyway, and everything was in Hebrew. But Selby kept telling me things. You know, she's sitting next to me, and she'd reach over and punch me, and she'd say, now, tomorrow morning, he's going to read from the Torah for his bar mitzvah. Yeah, okay, Selby. And so we had this child with us, you see, this little two-year-old child, Muffy. Well, Muffy is a beautiful child, and she's got these great big black eyes. And she was being so good. She was only two, and it was really asking a lot to take a two-year-old to something like this. Well, she didn't say a word. She just sat on my sister's lap for about an hour. And then she started squirming. So I sort of looked over at Phoebe, and I said, well, why don't you let her come sit on my lap for a while, and maybe she won't squirm around so much, because we were gradually getting through the service and getting to the three little Israeli girls who were going to read their speeches, and I wanted to hear the speeches, so I was doing anything I could do to keep
this child quiet. So Muffy got down, she walked over, and she got on my lap. Well, I was my sister was sitting against the wall, and I was sitting sort of in the aisle, in the traffic. First thing that happened, Muffy gets on my lap. The first thing that happens, this man walks by. He's one of the ushers. He's got a little sign on. He's an usher. And he walks by, and he looks at this child in my lap, and he reaches out, and he takes her chin, and he goes, "Oh, it's so cute," he says. "It's so cute. How old is it?" And I looked at him, and I couldn't think of anything to say. And so I said, "Oh, it's 2. "Oh, it's so cute," he said. "I got 2 at home. I'll trade you for it." So he goes on in, you know, and Muffy continues to sit on my lap, and everybody around is watching her, you know, because she's more out and where people can see her. And she was starting to really squirm around, and they'd started introducing everybody to introduce these girls, these poor girls, who'd come all the way from Israel. And then they had the mayor of Sarasota, they had the president of B'nai B'rith, they had the rabbi, they had the cantor, they had a representative from the Israeli embassy. They had all these people there giving 15-minute speeches apiece, welcoming these girls and giving them keys to the city of Sarasota. So Muffy is just really starting, it's too much for her. She's just too young and crawling over my shoulder. Well, I was just about ready to pass her on to somebody else when I realized that the woman behind me was sort of playing footsie games with her and keeping her occupied. And I thought, isn't this nice? You know, this woman is really helping me out. Isn't that nice? She's keeping this child occupied. You know, she's not bugging me. And then so I turned around and I was going to thank her, you know, just smile and say thank you. You know, so I turned around and I smiled. She's a very handsome woman sitting behind me. She looked me right in the eye. You know, she let me smile at her. She looked me right in the eye and she said, "What I want to know is why a baby this young is up so late." Well, I thought to myself, I am surrounded by Jewish mothers. Help! Everybody here thinks this is my child. I turned around. I could feel my ears getting red. I turned over to Selby and I said, "Selby, I think I have to take the baby home now." She said, "Oh, you're going to miss the speeches." Selby likes children just fine if she can just pinch their cheeks. She doesn't like to have them around. Yeah. She said, "You're going to miss the speeches." I said, "I know, but I think I better take the baby home. She's been up too late." Loudly, so the woman behind me would hear. I was ashamed into it. So I got up and I took the baby home right away, you know, and I sort of smiled at her as I went out, you know. Well, the thing about Jewish mothers is they are always right. She was absolutely right. The child fell asleep in the car taking her home. She was up too late. You know, Jewish mothers are always right. So I told everybody this when they finally got back after the speeches. I said, you know, the reason I left was that woman just shamed me. She just made me feel so badly about this child. And Selby said, "Oh," she said, "yes, I should have warned you." She said, "That was nothing. You didn't see the woman sitting next to Phoebe?" I said, "No." Said Phoebe sat down, and this woman sat down next to her, and she looked at Muffy, and then she looked away, and then she looked back again, and then she started doing her hands like this, you know, and looking at Muffy, and finally she just couldn't stand it anymore, so she turned around and she grabbed Muffy by both cheeks and just shook her head. "Oh, aren't you cute?" All these Jewish mothers. So we laughed about that. Oh, we really laughed. And then Frank said, "That's nothing." He said, "The Jewish mothers are nothing. I have the crowning story to tell you from my experience in synagogue." Frank is Polish. He's about 6'3" and weighs about 300 pounds. I mean, he's just enormous. He stands up and he's just, you know, way up there. And he's big, nice, sort of gentle man. And priestly, sort of. And he said, "We were sitting right inside, right by the door to the sanctuary." He said, "The man sitting in front of us was at a very good point for welcoming everybody into the synagogue. He would welcome everybody that came in, you know, he's sitting right there, he'd shake hands with them. And then as he was shaking hands with them, he'd reach out and he'd get their trousers, and he'd feel their trousers, and then he'd feel their shirt, and then he'd feel their coat, and then their tie. "Nice quality," he'd say, "nice quality." That's true. And Sally just died. She said, "He must be in the clothing business." So
So then we got off on the springboard being Frank and Susan, an ex-nun and an ex-priest. We got off on Salvi in Rome. Salvi said, I went to Rome, and the only people there that saved me were the nuns. She said to Susan, I was saved by the nuns in Rome. She said, I was in Rome alone, and that's a very bad thing to do. This is Salvi.
The Jewish.
She's Jewish. She said, I had a friend who's also an ex-nun who knew two nuns in Rome, and she knew a pension next to the convent. She gave Salvi the address of the convent and a letter of introduction to these nuns. And Salvi said, I was so glad they were there because I'd go out alone in the day and I'd just get this trail of people behind, men behind me, you know. They just sort of follow. She said, they're not subtle at all, not subtle at all. They walk up to you and they start talking to you and following you, and the next thing you know, they're taking off their wedding ring and throwing it at your feet and saying, Esposo, She said, I figured out what to do, though. I would let them follow me, and I would walk down the street to the convent, and I would stop at the convent doors, and I would say, I live here. And they would look horrified, and they would say, Convento? And I would say, sí, sí, sí. She said, they'd run, and I'd run. She said, the only bad thing was being there alone, other than that she didn't like all the men following her, was that I didn't speak Italian. She said, that was a little problem. She said, the people that ran the pension, the woman used to come in at 8 o'clock every night. She'd knock on my door, and she'd come in, and she'd start babbling in Italian, and I never knew what she was talking about, but she'd babble, and she'd point at the lights. Well, I didn't know what she was talking about, so I'd unscrew the light bulb and give it to her. She said, I think all she wanted me to do was not to leave the lights on all night. I think she just wanted me to turn the lights on. But I unscrewed the bulb and gave it to her anyway. And she said, and then that fool woman sent her husband in. And he started babbling away and pointing at the light fixture. So I said to him, standing in the dark, look, I don't have any more light bulbs. I gave my only light bulb to your wife. Would you go away now? She was in Rome. She was in Rome for Yom Kippur, or for Rosh Hashanah, I guess. That's Yom Kippur is the day, and Rosh Hashanah is the week, the Holy Week. And so she wanted to go to temple, and so she asked the nuns if she could go, if they knew a synagogue that she could go to. And they said, oh yes, and they gave her the address. And so she went. And she said, I was just mortified. I just had to leave. She said there were 500 people there. And not only was nobody paying attention to what was going on, but they were all speaking Italian. I couldn't take it. So I left, and I went back to the convent. And I said to my nun friend, she said, I just couldn't stay. I really couldn't stay there. There were too many people, and nobody was paying attention to what was going on. And this is a very important day to me. And so the nun looked at her and she said, you can use our chapel. And Selby said, well, I couldn't do that. She said, I'm not Catholic. I couldn't use your chapel. And besides, I don't have any books to read. And so the nun looked at her and she said, all you need is a book of Psalms, don't you? And Selby said, well, yes, I guess that's right. And so the nun gave her a book of Psalms and took her rosary. And they both went in, the nun and Selby went in to the chapel. And they sat there all afternoon, and the nun did her rosary, and Selby read Psalm for Yom Kippur. And Selby said, you know, that's the nicest Yom Kippur I've ever had. Isn't that nice?
That's really nice. Well. Now, what did you and Selby do in Boston?
In Boston? Oh, Selby... Well, Selby was supposed to write a newsletter for the community.
Yeah.
But the trouble was that we had very bad relations with the community at Tufts because we were across the street from Chinatown. And nobody at Tufts ever made any effort toward Chinatown. They Chinese people would not come to Tufts. They'd go to Boston City, which is farther down Harrison Avenue, because the people at the clinics at Boston City would be nicer to them than the people at Tufts. And so Selby was supposed to write a newsletter to
make the Chinese people feel a little bit better, but it was a very difficult thing for her to do. It was difficult for anybody. And so the whole time she was there, she only did two newsletters. And we used to say, you know, well, Selby doesn't really do too much except talk on the telephone, which was true. She was very good at talking on the telephone, but she never did get around to writing her newsletters very much. Yeah, but I think, she talks a lot, you know, and she'd come in the morning and she would just talk on the phone for about 90% of the day to various people around the hospital. And she eventually started working on the employee, they formed an employee council at the hospital. And she was the secretary, and that took up a lot of time after that, because she organized the meetings and then write up the minutes and everything. And Marcia and I decided that that was really a good thing for her to do, because she liked talking to people, and she was very good at talking to people. And she wasn't very good at writing newsletters about the Chinese community. Oh, the hair tearing we went through to get out that poor newsletter. Oh, the whole office would just, everything would drop, you know, because it was the 9 month period for Selby's newsletter to be born again. So we'd all and now she's in memo land up in but to her job is not, you know, what you want to look at about her. It's what's funny. Her humor is much better. We had a big Jewish brunch on Sunday. That was for Selby too. She was leaving, and we got all these lox and bagels, and we were gonna had a lot of people come over, and one of them, Gerald Hodges. He's the Hodges here, Jimmy Hodges at the university. Son and wife live in Sarasota, and so they were there, and they're good friends of our friends, and they're good friends of Marcia and Robert.
How'd that happen?
Through us, we introduced them, and so Gerald said, you know, the first time I ever had a Jewish breakfast, it was a little hard, he said, because I went home with a friend of mine, and her mother came in the next morning, and she said, would you like some breakfast? And I said, sure. And he said, and here she came with all this fish. She had all this white fish. Shelby said, yeah, that's right, you get white fish. And he said, and bagels. And so I started eating, and I was working away on these white fish, really working on them. I thought I was getting somewhere. She kept making me eat more and more and more. And Shelby said, yeah, that's right, you got to eat, you got to eat. You got to eat and keep up your strength, you know. And then Gerald said, well, finally what she did, she came and said, would you like some eggs? And I said, oh, yes, I'd love some eggs, anything but eating fish. And he said, and she walked in and she had this plate full of eggs, scrambled eggs and lox.
And lox.
And lox, which is raw salmon. So we said, oh, it's good, Gerald, you should eat it.
For breakfast.
Well, we went to the Aslo too, to the theater there on Saturday.
Yeah, you go, you get to the theater.
Yeah, I know.
Does all of your crowd do that?
Well, it's mostly my sister. She's the one that's always getting us to theater.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, she really likes it. She wanted to.
But she doesn't take part in them.
She just goes and watches. Yeah.
And that's the theater that was transported.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's beautiful. They bought it in Italy, the Aslo. It's at Elizabethan theater. They bought the whole thing and brought it over piece by piece and rebuilt it in Sarasota.
Mm.
So it's tiny. They have the little boxes that look right over the stage, and it couldn't hold more than a couple hundred people. And We sat. We called late for tickets, and so we sat right on the stage practically in one of the side boxes. It's actually not very good seats because you always get in the back for people's faces. They did.
What did you see?
The Crucible. Arthur Miller.
Does that perform well?
It does. I had read it a lot. It seems like I read it for about 3 or 4 English courses when I was in college, but I'd never seen it performed. And it's really about the Salem witch trials. And it's a very moving play.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, because they're accusing people falsely of witchcraft. Just hysterical children who are accusing everyone.
You mean take it seriously?
Yes, you can take it seriously. You really can when it's performed.
Yeah.
The children gave very good performances. The young girls who get hysterical and accuse everyone. And I had not known that it was written, that Arthur Miller wrote it at the time of the McCarthy trials, and that the people, because he was called up in front of the McCarthy and refused to testify, refused to give people's names. And Marcia said this. She said that the people in the play are people who took part in the... It's historically accurate, but then there are also people who took part in the McCarthy trials, like Danforth in the play is the judge who judges the witchcraft trials in Salem, but he's also McCarthy. And she said, and one of them is Nixon. You have to watch out because one of them is Nixon. We tried to figure out after the play who Nixon could have been. And there's one sort of little lackey that runs around taking the minutes of the trial, and we decided that was probably Nixon. And he wasn't too important a character, but he was sort of there all the time, writing everything down.
That was a right able thrust, wasn't it? That's the McCarthy movement.
Oh.
It was so widespread.
Everywhere, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. It was the same thing practically.
Well, McCarthy had a lot of followers too.
Interesting. Selby is so has its feeling for the Jewish thing. It's really strong.
Mm-hmm. She does. Yeah, what's that? I have a very easy time projecting into the Jewish world. I always wanted to convert when I was younger. I wanted to be Jewish so badly. I'm not sure why, but when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, I wanted to convert. And it's just, emotional attachment I have. Somehow. I think mostly it was because the only little Jewish girl that I knew was in my brownie troop, and she had Hanukkah for a week, and I only had Christmas for a day. I think that was really the reason.
I was wondering if it was.
I'm pretty sure that was, but I never missed a Passover with Marcia Gold when I lived in Boston.
But it goes way back.
I used to go to Passover with her and go home to Dot all the time with her.
Well, my friends, the Cornhebrews were Jewish, and they had a hard time being Jewish in Gainesville because all of the children's friends were Gentiles.
Yeah.
And so finally Art said, Chantal would say to me, but I want to be Christian. I don't want to be Jew. Because Christmas is so much fun. And then finally, she said, well, finally, her daddy said, well, all right, let's just have a Christmas tree and be Christians for Christmas. So that's what they did.
Yeah. Helen said they always had a Christmas tree, too.
We won't call it a Hanukkah bush.
I know, poor Marcia Gold Candy and I made her decorate a Christmas tree every year. She'd never had one until she lived with us.
So that was you and Marcia and Selby.
That were tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now, what do you have any? You plan to do something with this?
Well, I'm not sure. I can set it down. I have this afternoon, in part. I was sort of thinking that I would work with that tape of Miss Daisy's for a while. So.
Well, now, I don't remember seeing anything on your trip on the river with Candy. You didn't plan to do that, or did I just forget about it?
Well, I think we just forgot about it at the time.
I don't know. The mind won't work on new material, and you see, when you report on Candy, I just took it as sort of adolescent, and I was expecting to hear something interesting about Candy. So it took me a good while, you see, to get used to the idea that what you all were doing, deliberately, you see, was just reliving some of your old expeditions. Well, in that light, you see, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And you said that was
it. Yes, you said so, but
it gave you a handle, gave you something to look at Candy. Mm-hmm. You were looking for it.
And this time, yeah. Go ahead.
That's all.
Well, and this time I remembered going down to Sarasota. The last time I had tried to say, oh, Marcia and Robert throw off on people, and you know, trying, I think, too much to put things into that world that aren't there. And so I remembered we'd been talking on Thursday about you just do what you always do with them. And so I did. I didn't
yes.
go in trying to force anything else into it. I just let things happen, and they happened. We had that wonderful night at the synagogue. I mean, that I think I saw just so much, those little glimpses. See, we had the child and the clothes, and that just got us right in there. We didn't have to. It might have been more interesting if we'd seen the service, but we didn't. We couldn't see the service. There were too many people there.
Well, you let things happen. You have to help make things happen, but it's, you know, it helps them.
Yes, yeah, you just. You go along with them.
Sure.
That's all I'm saying. Sure. You just go into, and see, it was a perfect situation for me just to do what I've always done, because we worked together for so long, Marshall and Selby.
You ought to put it in some sort of light, you know. I don't know what sort. Just, gotta frame it somehow or other, you know, give it a little meaning. Now you see, I start making these statements, and I don't make anything of it. I don't know any of the Jewish festivals, and Yuma doesn't interest me. impossible. Now, you can make intellectual humor, but not laughing so. And Chaucer's humor, you see, if you call it humor, I don't call it humor. I use the wrong word.
But when you put it down, and you know, what he's doing is just opening it up. So you can come back and say something about it.
Yeah.
You don't have to believe what he's saying. Just, you know. So when you put this down, it you know, I see all sorts of prongs and things that you can use it, frame it.
I got into
in the experience that you
I've been sort of tired, and I've been trying to get my knees suppled up. They tingle all the time. They just caked with fatigue. Over months and months, you see. And I've been doing a little of it the last few days. I never take exercise, and they feel better. Anyhow, I haven't tried to get the train of thought. My brain was so squishy it wouldn't work anyhow. And I got into Eric Hoffer, and I was in that chapter one. I was trying to look at the process to see how this thing worked out after I made the statement. And I look back at that thing I wrote up and finished by Thanksgiving in the fall of '68, and Hoffer wasn't even in it. And I got to thinking, if it hadn't been for him, you see, what I had seen in him, I might not have been able to do this. So you see, what I did was make that statement, just sort of accidental, and the thing caught fire. I could use it. It works, you see. That the talk is informative, and it's an experience. Well, I got to turn it over. I was just trying to think, well, now what did I know about Hoffer? And you see, the New Yorker profile came out, and I got a copy of that. I just happened to be able to put my hand on it. It was in January 67. Well, by that time, I knew I had already got hold of the true believer. But I still learned a good bit from that New Yorker profile. I had a long tussle with Hoffer. I started out thinking, well, now this would be nice. I can use him as a freshman, as a sophomore. You see, everything I read, I try to use. I don't mean to teach, but I mean to use. And I got into it. I couldn't make anything of him. It was all abstract. It's all interesting, but all abstract. Well, the Knoxville people come down here, and they always like to have a little reading. And somehow or other we picked up the true believer and sure liked it.
You had those clients stay and you saw the interviews.
Yes.
That was one of the things that was that marvelous
yes.
series on the
yes.
television.
I saw those three times at least, right solid.
A long time.
8 or 10 of them, you know, half hour. Well, now this time they were coming down, and Faye always egged me on, gets me into it. And she said, well, why don't you, they like that Eric Hoffer, why don't you pick that up again? I thought, I don't know anything about it. And that's when I got into it. that was the time I got into it. You see, it had knocked me down all these times. And what I saw was the same sort of statements, you see, I made about the countryside. You see, he goes into all sorts of subjects, but the heart of it is just one simple statement. And he says it over and over again. That's the heart of it. That the autonomous individual, just a free, ordinary, independent individual, is subjected to so many strains and stresses that it is a great privilege to practice self-renunciation and exchange his liberty for equality. Now, I've said that in a long way, but the basic thing is a man can't stand up and face liberty. And that's the heart of the true believer. The true believer gives him something to give him a start. It makes him equal. He can practice self-renunciation and all those things, self-sacrifice, and die for his country. But it's all based on that, you see. Now you can take it in a different field. Like he says in the colonial thing, the Russians have all the advantage because when they go in, they have a mass, a corporate alternative for them. When we go in, all we have to offer them is just free enterprise and the independence of an individual. And that's the one thing they don't want. Makes them uncomfortable.
They want to be true believers. Yeah.
They got to stay within the family or within the tribe or something like that. Well, so you see, he can turn that over. He's a master, you see, at handling those statements. That's all he does. He's got no information in it. It's all statements. He just turns them all the time, constantly. Well, so, and then I got to thinking, well, that's just part of it. That's just part of it. I had used Emerson, that basic statement he makes about the individual and the self-reliance, which you all haven't brought out too clearly. And I used that and read all these people in that light. I even used Poe, and I could read Ligeia and Usher and make something of them that is not in the books. It makes something of them. Just that one episode statement. But you see, and that underlies Ishmael. Well, I don't know how far you can take it, you see. I've used it. Ike and the bear and with Ratliff, you see. It enables me to bring them to make something out of them. Well, it looked like, and then you see this thing that I said experience. Well, what's so magical about the term experience? Well, to me there was a great deal, because I had already thought in terms of the abstract. If people live that, and the students live that, and the whole educational system has so much of that in it that it has no content. Now this morning I sat here like a dumb bunny and let one of the most remarkable things go. I didn't put it down. It's this young fellow who wrote Love Story and made $5 or $6 million in and he's a professor of classics at Harvard.
Yeah,
he's around
yeah.
30 and sort of a fragile fella with long arms and long bony fingers and sort of looks as if he hadn't even picked up a broom. And this fella, Gene Shalit, kept saying to me, "It's very nice. All of it was in good humor." But he kept coming back to it. He says, "You write these things," and he has an appointment at Munich now to teach the classics in German. And then he'd come back here at Harvard again and teach his classics in English. And he said that would be sort of refreshing to get back into English. Well, he wasn't pedantic at all.
You know,
Shalit wanted to know what difference it had made with him. Well, he says it had been hard on him, and he had hit out. But the one thing he had learned to do, he was a runner, and he could run through Central Park 50 or 20 miles and come back, and the hurt he wouldn't feel so much. That's one of his terms. And the thing Shalit got around to was, if you write about these things, why don't you're son of a rabbi and you've done all these things, why don't you write something about yourself? And he says, "You must have a great deal of innocent things." And he says he didn't know just what was interesting about him. And that's the heart of the matter. There ain't anything interesting about him. You see, all he lives is an intellectual life.
They ran him out of Yale. He says, contrary to that, he's still a social assistant professor at Yale.
But the students just
uh-huh.
booed him down for writing yeah. Love Story. They did. I had a friend there.
Said
they just wouldn't nobody take his classes. Nobody had anything to do with him. They just gave him such a hard time for writing that schmaltzy thing. Oh, and it is pure schmaltz.
$5 or $6 million
Well,
you could buy the whole college.
But he.
And I said, yeah, just let that go.
That would have been something, though, to look at.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
Gene Shalit was good.
Oh, yes, he was good. And you see, Leslie Street with all that stuff of his. He's the same boat.
We're gonna get Leslie here in June.
I don't want to play any games. I'm tired of that.
Well, anyway, Leslie.
Well, anyhow. you see, that abstract, and then I worked up the Freudian. You see, through the governess, and. Now, here's the thing that baffles me. The thing I thought I could do, you see, in some of those classes up there, is I could show them those things. You see, they have no hold of Freud. They always use big words, something schizoid, you see. They can't take it just in a basic sense of being nervous with too much on you. That's Freudian, and that's where it applies, and you lose sleep, that's Freudian, that's what he puts into the governess. I had that, and so you see, that was why, you see, and you see, one of the things that Suzanne learned was that, and she had gone through that with me a great deal, and wonder what happened, and look what happened, is that she let that same Freudian thing get the best of her up in Georgia, and they ran off. ago, she let herself get too close in there and living with the family, and she got all nervous about it. And then when she gets nervous, she gets everybody else nervous. So they just got in the car and ran off. She did it. So I just quit. I just, it doesn't do any good to me, you see. It's, I don't know, it saves me from all sorts of traps. Just that simple diagnosis, it works. I had that and the abstract, you see, and I had that Emersonian world. So when I got hold of this world experience, you see, it's magic. It's just exactly what I needed, something satisfying, something that this classics professor doesn't have, and all these people that I know don't have, that Mr. Wheeler has. And you say, why would I put my time on it? It's a breath of life.
We were saying the other last night, or when was it, that, you know?
I didn't realize all that.
Mr.
Weaver
never stopped learning. Mm-hmm. It's the most amazing thing in the world.
And he's still a jump ahead of me.
Yeah.
And there he is, Hank's dead, two-thirds dead. I really didn't know that he's going to be there yesterday morning. He was in such bad shape the night before. I really didn't. And when we got there, he'd had a glass of home-churned buttermilk. And it had, when I got to the door, he met me at the door before I got there. I took some food over there, you know. He came out, and he said, he wasn't holding his heart like he did the night before. He said, you know, I had a glass of fresh churned buttermilk. And I went right to sleep. It was the first time I slept in weeks. And guy came up and he said, let me show you my beads.
He wanted to go out and see if they'd come up. He didn't know himself. Because mm-hmm. that's 3-inch rain. Mm-hmm. Didn't he have to see.
And he talked all along the way about things, about his pepper. And he just is interested, and you know, he just.
Yeah, he had a little skylark, and he says, you see that string along there? Remember the string?
Mm-hmm.
He says, that's to keep the rabbits. Well, he says it's also to make the road straight.
Yeah, he was having a heart attack tonight.
So you see, that's what I put into all of it. You see, it's a Freudian, it's abstract. Get in that Emersonian thing. You see, that's what I read into all of it. I don't care what it is, that's what I read into it. And it holds it. Even if it's a hunting thing, you see. For one thing, this last little thing Rick did, he's throwing off. Baiting word.
Mm-hmm.
And but what it is, you see, they're all in on it. All in on it. And what it is, now here's the thing. There he was over there. Rick dropped in there, and we hadn't seen him in a week or two. I kept thinking, well, yeah, I paid $17 to get his car service and won't even come over here. Well, he hadn't been able. Mm-hmm. Rick dropped in there, and he was feeling well enough to talk, and he's very quiet. And he told this little, he just picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
This remarkable little experience from the 30s. And I was in here with my brain squishy. And I kept thinking after I heard Rick talk tell that story. God almighty. If it was just something that says that I could pick up and bring to life, whether my brain squashed it or what, as there ain't, you see, I can't do it. And he can. See, what I see in it is something that ain't anymore. I don't care how important they are, they don't have it. Not now. But you see, I've got that long preparation for it. You see, I've been whittling away on that all this time. I did that before the New Yorker article came out. And now I see the New Yorker didn't understand Harper. He says, Harper has his gloomy view of where I had then. Well, it's not gloomy. It's not gloomy. He makes a statement that opens up all those things.
It's just these statements, one after the other. And as the guy said, it just helped him to see what he could see from Emerson too.
Well, we had a nice session Tuesday, Thursday. Once a week, twice a week, you think's enough?
2 or 3 times a week, yeah. Rick's gonna be so stuffed full when he goes over to that sauna every once in a while.
Oh yes.
You know.
Yes.
Oh, and don't forget, we had a call tonight while y'all were gone.
Center. Emma Keep was in there today.
Give us, she hadn't heard about it. Just give it to the praying pros.
Yeah, just tell everybody about
it. Well, you see, Buster's out of commission pretty much.
Use your outdoor voice.
Well, Buster's out of commission pretty much. There's no one goes over there for car repairs.
I'll never tell you, I haven't been over there much. But the time or two I've seen him, he seems to be looking inward.
Yes, and working on the same car all the time.
Yeah.
Same old car. And there's nobody over there. And Eddie's the only
one. Nobody over there.
No.
Nobody.
No. There's not even people to sit and talk with.
No.
But over at Eddie's, you can't get off by yourself. He's got more work than he can do. And he's got not only cars, but he's got the tractors now.
You don't want them correlatives now. I don't want to have to tell you that again.
I get that too.
But, well, Emma Keep was in there to see about his car getting fixed. And John McRae was down there. Jack McRae was down there giving Janet a hard time, telling her, you know, well, I've got pickers now. Now, I need someone to pick up those full crates of oranges and put them in the high lift. He wanted Janice to do
put
that.
Put them on the belt?
No, pick them up. Dump them. It was much more than Janet could do. That's why he asked her.
And no belt?
I don't know what he's got. She didn't say. She just said a lift. He must have something to flip it up and dump them in the truck. I've seen those wooden crates so big, they'll hold 80 to 100 pounds of oranges.
I couldn't get one end off the ground.
Well, I was going to suggest that maybe Debbie could do that. Since Janet couldn't.
And they know everybody down there.
And when they come to talk.
Yeah. Well, there's a fellow in there this morning. Had an old 51 Chevrolet pickup truck. That old thing, it's got leaf springs front and rear, and you haven't seen that in a long time. And Eddie had it on the lift. And it was a black man on it, kind of old, been over these big thick lenses. and had brake trouble, and Eddie just talked to him. Well, young man, I think we found it. You could see the brake fluid leaking out of one of the wheels. I think it'll be $250, and we'll have to go all the way around. That'll be $12, and then the labor, if you bring it in Thursday. And the fellow just talked to Eddie like he'd known him. Yes, sir, I'd be glad to do that. What time Thursday? Oh, anytime, same time, this is fine. And he's got the natural opening. See, they'll all talk to Eddie.
I'll talk to him.
And he's got that manner where he just gives everybody a hard time.
Yeah.
And there's always a light touch in him. Some lady drove up today. Oh, it's Miss Thompson again. She's going to complain about something. And he sent Janet out. But Franklin quit to go to work for Barclay Toyota. And he's needing help there on weekends, pretty much.
Yeah.
Just someone to tend the front, you know. Greet the people. So I probably stopped him. And
yeah. You know, I tried to help Cookie a time or two. Yeah, it was just, you know, he went across the street to get a hamburger, and you know, I couldn't find a place to open the hood. It's all so different, you see. You just really got to know those models before
yeah.
before you put water in.
Now we'll get Debbie a packing crate job on the weekend. Isn't
it? Debbie got so many jobs, see, already. Everywhere she goes, they'll give her a job.
I know. I felt guilty about not helping her mama today. Debbie, put this down. I'm interested in this Selby. You can put this down and look at it and frame it a little bit. What's his name? Okay. Look at it.
And you saw Connor.
Yeah, you know, that was remarkable. I just turned, and I thought, well, I'll go the long road out to 441. And it had rained, what, Sunday? It was wet. And I'll just take my chances and see if I can make it. Well, I got down there around the curve, and here comes this tractor. And I thought, oh, Lord, no, the roads are too soft. We'll never get by. But I pulled over, and I could see it was Patterson. So I stuck my hand out and waved, and he slowed down. I didn't think he would. Because Patterson comes along at a good clip when he's on the road. So he slowed down, so I got out. And I couldn't hear what he was saying, because he had that motor running. And see, the muffler's long gone in that tractor, and he's got an old piece of car exhaust that he's just stuck in there. And it runs off at this crazy angle, sticking out to the side, and it's still got the fitting there on the end. So you get the feeling that the thing's upside down, and it's belching out white smoke, thick white smoke. And noisy, just popping. And he finally cut it off, and I could hear him saying, "Get it welded." And I said, "Patterson, what you got there?" He said, "Oh, it's getting a leak in there. I'm going to have that welded." And I looked, and you could see the water running down the side of the engine. You couldn't quite see where the leak was. And he said, "Shoot, I get that welded and get going. Had a leak in my water pump, but I'm not worried about that. Just want to get that welded." And I said, "Well, Patterson, weren't you cutting that land up there? I see that's getting kind of grassy." "Yeah, I cut that three times." I said, "Well, that had those high weeds." "Yes," he said, "it tore my radiator up. Had to get me another radiator. Cost me $10. Got a screen up there now, another radiator. Had to put a head on, too. That was $50. And I looked over. And you know, he's always got that orange reflector on the back of his tractor for driving down the road. Well, he's got this big tail light now, and it's round, and it's you know, aluminum, and it's got red reflector. It looks like it's out of about a 64 Ford, like he's got sitting in his yard. And he said, "Lady gave me that. It'll burn. I fixed it up. I got it where it'll burn." and he grabs this wire that had been, you know, stripped at the end, and he grabs another one. This is right underneath the steering wheel, and he touches them together. Of course, they spark and everything, and the light comes on. And I thought, well, Patterson, and I look down, and there's this little headlight, and that's bolted onto the fender too, but it's aiming behind you. I said, well, Patterson, you got yourself a headlight here too? Shoo, that'll burn. And he grabs another two wires and jams them together, and the headlight comes on. That's so I can plow. And I thought, well, that's the way Patterson would do it. He would shine the light behind him, because when he plows, he's always half turned in that seat and looking behind him. That's how I can tell who's plowing, if it's Burnett with his head turned and his pipe sticking out, looking behind. Says, yes, sir, I can burn those lights. I got me a battery. Got me a 12-volt battery. Well, you know, I'd seen you buy the battery from Eddie, and I looked over. That big blue shell 12-volt battery. I don't fool around with no cheap battery. That's got a guarantee on it. Well, it's got a 42-month guarantee. And that's the biggest battery you can buy. Take that out and put it in my car, he said. Got my starter fixed, too. I ain't messing around with this hand crank anymore. Sure, tear yourself up. $9 got me an armature put in there. And he had his starter all fixed up. He reached over and he pushed the button, the thing kicked over. Then he pushed again, it started up, and he turned it off. Then he pushed again and started up again, and he turned it off.
All this in the middle of the road.
Just standing right there. And I said, well, Patterson, you got to take care of this tractor. This ain't no light tractor. This tractor works. Shoot, he says. Nobody drives this tractor but me. Not my boys, not anybody. I said, no. Lord knows what they do. It might tear up your tires. He said, yes, and take it off and drive it through the woods or down some road. You don't know. It might tear your tires up. Well, I had a flat this morning. Right flat. Right tire. Got up this morning. It was flat. I fixed that. I said, well, Patterson, that's an awful job to pull one of them tractor tires off. He said, shoot, I've taken those tires off before, but I just popped it off this time. I got me a John Henry. That's a crowbar. I just popped that off and put a cold patch on it. Pumped it up by hand with my hand pump.
A tractor tire.
He says, now I'm going to get me some new tires, $150. I said, that much for tires? Shoot, he says, cost me $150 for one tire, six ply, get me some good tires. Put some water in them so I can get some wear, too. Them's been on about 3 years. Of course, those tires, see, there's just none of that big, thick ribs left in them. They just about punch your finger through them.
Oh.
They're all rotten, the old tires he's been running them 3 years.
On the road and everywhere.
Yes, going.
Well, yeah, he just runs
takes
up, down
up to
the
Gainesville.
Road. Yeah, all the way to Gainesville.
And this is an old Alice Chalmers tractor. It looks like an old steel beam with a motor sitting on it. That's about all it looks like. And he's got just that spring seat. Well, all this time, see, he's got his pipe. And he keeps opening this little toolbox beside him, and it's just crammed full. It's got old socket wrenches and screwdrivers, you know, a little bit of rust covering everything. And he's got a little can of Prince Albert in there. And he's packing his pipe the whole time in life. Little corncob pipe he's got. So I remembered he used to pull drag his hair down the road sometime. I looked over at this washed out spot in the road. I said, you know, the way they tear these road up with the graders, they ought to get you to do some work on this road. And he said, shoot, yeah. There's a hole back there. If you get your car in it, sure enough, I have to get somebody to tow you out. I was pulling them out yesterday. And I said, in all that rain? Shoot, he said, they get stuck. I pull them out and make $10. Down there in McIntosh, had a funeral. Pull one out and turn around, another one stuck. Well, I didn't need to do that, though. They wanted me to get down and hook that chain. I didn't do that. I said, no, sir, I don't have to do this. I got another job. So they people had to get down with those nice clothes on and hook that chain. And I just pull them out, make
$10. Wow, really?
And then he just started it up. Said, I gotta go. Sure gotta go. Get this welded. I got a job plow there. That'll work out. I got somewhere else to go. And he just shifted in the road gear. And that engine would hardly falter. He whooshed down that road and the mud flying off the tires and he'd just be springing in the sea.
Why, Rick?
And I thought, that is remarkable. I caught him with a charge. And he lined out his whole tractor for me. And that is the first contact I've made with him. And that's the first time I could see anything about Burnett, and that's his tractor.
Well, that is remarkable.
And that didn't take 5 minutes.
And you can just flip it down on the paper, and that's it, and get it out.
You know, it's remarkable what can happen in 5 years.
That was a high point of my day.
Uh-huh. Stopped up there on that muddy road.
That was such a picture to see him take off. And you know, he guns that engine. He just gunned it a few times and let the clutch out, and he went. He was showing me the mud just a fly. And there must have been a picture of him on that, just sitting in that pouring rain. You can hook the chain up, because I got another job. I don't need to do it.
I was thinking the same thing at a funeral.
We pulled up down there looking for Burnett one day, and we looked down the road going on down towards 441, and there was this car just zooming away right into the horizon, and found out that Burnett. We just missed him, just missed him. Now, I haven't seen him in a touring car in a long time. He probably in him. But he can sit back in that and just take wings.
Yes. He does the same thing on that tractor.
Yeah. And that's the farmer's reported on him. He says, you see Mary Liza, that's his daughter. And she's one of the nice lived over there on Simon Ranch, you see, down the hill from where the farms and the Van Arnhems live, right down to the foot. And she was the only one I thought that was mounting the thing, but I didn't know the others. Mary Liza, and oh, she had such good of a manner. Oh, that's not the way I said it. Would associate her with Burnett. And he'd go over there. And I think she raised his children for him. And if I said that's what he did, he'd come down that other road and cross the state line road and never stop. Never slow up. He used to have that big bus out there, you know. He got it closer and closer into the main rut.
Yeah, you know, you'd have to just get off in the ditch to pass it. He'd put it out in front of his house.
Yeah. And I never complained. I just thought to myself, well, that's the only one left with spirit. I'll get off her road. Oh, he sure fixed me up here. That.
Tell him.
Oh, I can't tell. You see, I got Burnett to do a little plowing up here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he fixed me. Oh, he fixed me. But I sure got some tapes.
I tried to find out from old Jake Brown what happened over there. I just said, boy, Burnett, somebody like that doing it, said, oh, yeah, Burnett Patterson did that. That's all he'd say.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the first time I ever met Jake.
Outside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He was cutting that Johnson grass. And I said, isn't this Johnson grass? He said, yes. And I said, well, this stuff's pretty hard to fight. Yeah, I said, I think I'm doing just a little bit of good. He had an old Alice Chalmers tractor, too, with just small tires on it. About 30 years old. And I said, you know, you got to work fast. No, he said, you got to work fast. And I said, yeah, you do. In fact, I've never met anybody who could work fast enough. And he said, well, what it is, this just wait a little too late to plant, I think. Wait a little too late. About that time, you could hear the whistle blow over there at Franklin's Mill. I said, oh, 5 o'clock, I'm not done. But he's cut it for Isaiah or somebody.
Oh, it's not his.
No.
He's,
Isaiah somebody.
I don't know who.
Well, hell, Isaiah lives in Miss Bessie's house there. He's the one.
Oh.
He's the one Miss Daisy tells you about. She says if Isaiah tells you he'll do it, he'll never get done.
Oh, gee.
Yeah.
Bunch of watermelons out behind Bessie's house. Whole bunch of them, and he couldn't sell them, and he couldn't, and he wouldn't give them away. And Miss Daisy said, oh, she'd love to have a watermelon, but them Isaiah's watermelons, I wouldn't say anything. And Bessie never offered to give you one of Isaiah's watermelons either.
I wasn't in on that. I offered Isaiah to use my tractor. Well, David, we did some fencing.
Got right in and got some physical.
Yeah, that's nice. I enjoyed that.
Still got to do a little more.
Yeah. We're not quite half through, I guess.
Well, I said, I had a proposal. I said, Rick's circulating now. He's got all these places to stop. He knows he's got countryside, and David's got places to stop. And before Christmas, we went along with Debbie and enjoyed Europe. And after the first time, she went along with us. And I think it's now time, this next term, for everybody to pick his own subject. I really do. By that, you know, you got the whole thing. If I had time and didn't have my own business, I would just make something out of Miss Daisy. That's the most beautiful thing we've got.
Yeah, there's nothing you'll never have.
And you talk about publishing, that ought to be somewhere.
I have no idea what to do.
That one little thing of talking to the goose.
You see, we've got a good bit that's published already. We've got all this on Mr. Nealon.
Yeah.
And the reason I had to drop that was my mind was working so slow. My mind. I just thought I'd put a little extra effort on these chapters,
mm-hmm.
but they're still going slow. So I'm just going to exercise my knees a little bit and just let them entertain me. Yeah. Oh, we a few days.
Few days.
This new cast of characters, like I told you, it'd take me a good while to sort of get into it.
I never saw anybody's mind work the way guys does. So Sometimes he just latches right on, but usually if it's something outside of his orbit, he fights it, like the candy, like candy. And the other day he's standing out there by the fence and he said, "Well, why didn't you tell me that that's what Daddy was seeing in candy?" I said, "What do you mean?" Well, he said, that statement opens it all up. That's just what they did in Greece. I said, "Well, that's what she said." "Well, she didn't say it strong enough, or you didn't say it strong enough." It just takes me so long to see when I've got my mind on something else. You see? So any time there's a new cast of characters, you have to sort of work him over on it.
That's right, if they would.
Yeah, you have to work him over until he gets it. It's the same thing. Let me talk a minute. It's the same thing with Suzanne and Bubba. He said, "I don't want to hear about that horse. I'm not interested in that horse. You don't know anything about a horse. You don't even know what end's which. And I don't want to hear about it.
I don't want to hear you talk about a horse.
Well, Suzanne just was by at a time. And first thing you know, she laid this thing on his desk. How was that that happened?
I was the one that saw it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She kept it. And Guy came to him.
I saw it right off.
Well, that's right. That's right. It was the horse. And you admitted
it. For the first time, though, she was reporting on the stable.
That's right. That's the best thing she ever did. One of the best things.
And Bubba was in it.
And then the last
thing you read.
Yeah.
The last thing in the world he wanted to hear about was
Rome. I saw that before she did.
That's right.
But, you know, I went along with her.
Yeah. And I remember you said, "God."
But it took a long time.
"Don't let me hear about love. That's the last thing in the world I want to hear."
Yeah.
So, you just got to stand up for what you see. Because he's just sort of dumb sometimes.
Well, I'll tell you.
His mind's a pup. And I don't know why it's not.
Yeah.
And his knees are worse than that. And I would be too if I had to stand at that typewriter.
Well, I'll tell you, Faye, they things come easy to them. And they never have come easy to me. See, everything I have, I've had to work hard for it. All the insight I have, you see, I never got to be an authority in Wordsworth. You see, if I'd done that, things would have been simple.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was saying the other day, who'd come out here and read with me if I was an authority in Wordsworth?
When
he came along with a dissertation, he wouldn't take a subject that he could just work on.
I didn't.
He wouldn't do it. He manufactured one.
I didn't.
He had to deliberately
say I wasn't going to do anything. I don't know what happened.
You just had to take one to develop yourself. It's just hard to do.
Well, I didn't do it just to develop
it. I know you didn't. But that's the way it turned out.
But I wasn't in this far off. You see, I went to China and all the way over there. I didn't know where I was going. They didn't tell us. And when I found out, we were in the Red Sea. 110 degrees on a liberty ship, and found out we were going to stop at Bombay, and I thought, God almighty, of all the places in the world that I'd ever wanted, didn't want to go, was Bombay. Well, I had to make something out of it. Yes. I made something out of it.
You were gone 2.5 years, and you wrote every day. And I've got all the letters upstairs, and they need to be edited. You want to edit it?
Well,
have years of time. I'm a serious
man. Not worse.
Yes, they are, too.
Sort out.
Just what
but,
you said.
But you see, the struggle is in them. You call it the struggle. It was fascinating. For me, it wasn't exactly fascinating. You see, I didn't have a hold of anything enough. But look how long it took. I worked on that all the time.
Yeah. And not once did he ever, I think he looked at China, but not once did he ever look at the backwoods of China. He looked at it at its best. You know,
yeah, I was in the backwoods, but it didn't.
I mean, he wouldn't let himself be depressed. Oh, no. And what he... We all of us who read his letters envied him being there and wished we were there too.
There's nothing to eat.
And there wasn't anything that wasn't
true. But we ate had no nourishment. It's about peanuts. When I got home, quit taking Atibrin, stuff that made you look yellow. I popped right out with malaria. This is big cases. I got plain quinine and I knocked it out. But I didn't get dysentery. I could have. In India, I ate at all the railroad stations. I'd eat this, what do they call it?
Running around France in a car.
At the railroad station. Say, don't you sell that. Don't you sell that. God damn it. I won't listen to that car. That's a nightmare.
But no, not...